technical moment here. Tonight we have, I have the great pleasure of introducing two of my favorite people. One of whom, the more illustrious of the two, Stuart Gudnick, was a student of Taiyu teacher Robert Ennis. He is himself vice president of a software startup company. He is a serious student of and performer on the shakuhachi. We just received an email from someone, a fourth-way teacher on the other side of the planet, on the island Mauritius, who mentioned in this email that Stuart writes with, I believe he said, verve, eloquence, and there was a third positive adjective. Mm. I don't recall what the third one was.
And tonight's talk is on vanity.
Well, we'll see. And then the slightly less illustrious Rob Schmidt, I'm happy to introduce. That would be Dr. Schmidt, that's true. Rob and his famous PhD. It does tricks when he allows it to. Rob also studied with Robert Ennis. He is a chameleon, as so many of us in the fourth way are. When tact is called for, he can be tactful. When brilliance is called for, he can be brilliant. When modesty is called for, sometimes he falls short. But here we are tonight. Welcome. Put on my official modest cap, yes, and my mantle of authority.
My goodness.
Voila. So, it is to return to a slightly more serious note for a moment. It is my pleasure to dedicate this talk tonight to Walter Bloom. Many of you know Walter Bloom. He is, I believe, 88 years old. A fixture of the spiritual scene here in Sebastopol for many years. He first started studying Zen back in the 70s and at the San Francisco Zen Center, and has continued his studies and brought a level of verve and vivacity to his 88 years, every day that I've ever had the pleasure of seeing him and chatting with him. He is now undergoing his passing from this existence as we speak, probably in the next couple of days or so, I'm told. But all the reports I have is that he is doing an outstanding job at that, as he has done throughout the years that I have known him. Here in town, he is. For many years he's been a member of one of the groups that meets here, called the Sutra Salon, a group devoted to study of the Buddhist scriptures, and I could tell a lot of stories about Walter in that context, but of course he was not present on Tuesday night at this meeting, the most recent meeting. But one of the people who had been able to see him earlier that day told the story that Walter, who's been going in and out of consciousness a bit, apparently quite consistently conscious today, as a matter of fact, from what I hear, but in any event, he's been going in and out of consciousness at times, and at one point someone asked him if he was dreaming when he was going in and out of consciousness, and his response was, "All of life is a dream." So Walter is maintaining the authority of clarity, even to the end, apparently, and that is a great achievement, a very great achievement, and we can count ourselves, those of us who have known him, very lucky to have known him. So I'm happy to dedicate this talk to him tonight. I don't say his memory yet, because even though I have him in my memory well fixed forever, he's still in the body, insofar as I'm aware. I hope I'll even get a chance to see him before he goes. We'll see. So, Walter is a good, and the dedication to Walter is a good place to start our discussion of karmic manure, which is a topic that can easily lend itself to a focus on some of the darker aspects of the production of karma. But his example is a nice demonstration that karma need not be only bad, it can be good as well. That's not to say that we don't want eventually to be able to cut it or end it entirely, eventually. But good karma is a wonderful thing. And some of the good karma that comes from producing good karma even ends karma, too. So it's a double boon, double blessing. I don't know if you wanted to jump in here at any point.
I'll find my spot.
Okay. And then you'll be off and running, as is your way. This tea is very good. I'll have some more. So, I wrote the description for this talk, but to be honest with you, I can't remember a word of it at this point.
Well, then maybe I should start.
That would be fun.
All right. Well, there's a notion in the talk.
See, he found his spot.
There's a notion in the description, because I just read the description. There's a notion in the description about that our life is filled with eating substances of various orders. And we're all very used to the idea of eating food. Our body needs food. We consume solid matter, we drink fluids, our stomachs digest them, energy products are extracted from that substance, and higher level energy, higher level products are produced in our system. And similarly, we have an analogous process that takes place as we breathe. We breathe air in, and that air is used as energy for our system. So we have this idea that we are in contact with the outside world, with our exterior lives in some form, because we eat parts of it, we breathe parts of it, and use the substances thereby to fuel our existence. But less often considered is a idea that I think it probably occurs in other traditions, but the fourth way tradition, the Gurdjieff tradition, was particularly articulate about this, is that there's another substance, there's another food that we eat that we don't pay as much attention to, and that's the food of our impressions. So if you consider, we are sensory organs, or organisms. We have trillions of nerve cells that are receiving information from the outside universe. And if, whereas you might be able to go a day, a few days without food, and maybe at least a couple days without water, maybe a few minutes without air. The claim is that if our impressions stopped, we would just, essentially cease to be as organisms. That we are receiving so much information in the form of impressions. And what do we do with these impressions? Well, the problem in the ordinary condition of most of our lives is that these impressions come in, and rather than being digested in a harmonious process to extract higher energetic products out of those impressions, just like when we eat food, what happens is that we have this kind of psychological or conscious indigestion that takes place. And what that means is that impressions come in and we immediately associate them to well-worn pathways in our thinking apparatus, our emotional apparatus, and even our body apparatuses. So when we see something, we have a new experience. In the ordinary conditioned mode of consciousness, we immediately have no sense of freshness, but more of a sense of a mechanical response where well-worn emotions are called up, well-worn associations are called up, reactive processes are called to the fore, and we act according to a script that we've internalized at some point in our existence. And that represents indigestion in the sense that this vast energy that's coming into us is not allowed to be digested in a way that would naturally produce a kind of higher grade substance that might actually change the way that we experience our lives. Rather, we have the psychological or conscious experience that's very much like when you eat a very heavy Mexican food, and I know whereof I speak because I just came from New Mexico for the last week, and you consume this heavy sort of grease-laden substance and it kind of just sits there and doesn't change. And you feel sort of heavy and you feel kind of sluggish. And that happens not only at the physical level, but that happens at our level of consciousness. So the subject of the talk, the notion of karmic manure and the transformations thereof, speaks to this process of digestion and offers a kind of Alka-Seltzer of the mind, if you will, to help us learn how we might better metabolize these impressions and do something with this vast resource of energy that's constantly bombarding us at every moment of our lives.
I prefer puer.
That's true.
Rather than Alka-Seltzer. Puer, as you may know, this happens to be the type of tea that we're drinking right now. It's the class of tea that the Chinese have traditionally used to aid in the digestion of a heavy meal. And other things as well, to serve in place of the hair of the dog, when one has consumed a lot of alcohol, for a lot of digestive properties.
And paradoxically, to get back to the theme of our talk, puer is a class of tea whose processing includes a step likened unto composting.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So back to manure.
Okay, fair enough. The process of composting is something that gardeners, of course, are familiar with. But it's not just something that happens through deliberate practice. It's also something that happens naturally through the processes of nature. We leave things behind us throughout our lives, and we leave impressions behind us throughout our lives, which are composted by the universe and turned into other substances. And one of the claims of spiritual practice is that there is a way to leave impressions behind that do not simply go through the composting process willy-nilly, that they actually can create a special, more complete form of composting. More complete in the sense that it produces effects that are intentional as they go through their process. Everything's being composted all the time in a very real sense. Everything is transmuting into something else at all times. That's happening with our bodies on a regular basis, and that's why we have to go use the toilet several times a day, because there are processes happening in our bodies. And that same process happens when we interact with people, when we go to work and do our jobs, when we breathe air. We are transmuting substances into other substances. So the question becomes, do we have a way to do that intentionally, to provide some guidance to the direction that these products that find a home in these organisms for a time and then move on to other locations in the universe at varying rates? Is there a way to create an effective form of intentional creation of substances within our organisms such that the effects that we leave behind us are not simply willy-nilly, are not simply the product of coincidence, apparent coincidence? Back to you. Unless we have questions at this point. So it's all pretty straightforward stuff.
Well, I'll continue the theme of digestion, and we'll probably somewhere intersect in the middle with digestion and composting. But the notion of what it means to receive an impression and to actually metabolize that impression is well worth spending some time on. So I mentioned before that what might be called psychic indigestion happens when an impression comes into us through our senses, through our senses of touch or senses of vision, whatever, and we reactively respond to that with a pre-planned or sort of pre-programmed script. Someone says something to us, we take offense. Something happens to us, we feel angry or depressed. Maybe we feel worried. Maybe we feel threatened. Maybe we walk in a particular way, you know, holding our body in a particular way. All of these are various kinds of mechanical responses to external stimuli that are coming in. So what can we do differently? Well, in our tradition, in the Fourth Way tradition, the tradition originally sort of brought to the West by Gurdjieff, there's a long-standing notion, which we've certainly elaborated under Robert's guidance at Tayu, that it's possible to put attention on what is coming into us in a different kind of way. And what that means is that we can be aware of the impression that's coming in as well as simultaneously being aware of the arising internally of the reactive responses to whatever is coming into us at a given moment. So there's a kind of a dual awareness that is being suggested here. And it's not common because most of the time, particularly when we're distracted and not paying attention and we're feeling a little bit rushed, our relationship to the outside world is sort of right at the surface. Whatever happens, we react to it. Whatever someone says, we don't contemplate, we don't let it in, we don't hold a space for it, we just kind of immediately associate to whatever the well-worn response is. And that process, which we refer to as being identified with the functioning of our organism, doesn't go any further than skin deep. We are just our sense of who we are, our sense of I is determined in that moment by whatever reaction is coming up, whether we're angry, whether we're frightened, whether someone's cut us off on the freeway and we're shaking our fists, whether we're worried about losing our jobs, whatever the particular context. But with this kind of dual attention, the recommendation is that we can be aware of both the incoming sensory information and at the same time be aware of the arising in the functioning of our organisms, of the thoughts that are coming up, the feelings that are coming up, the sensations that are arising in our body. And we can be aware of that stuff without being identified with it, without losing kind of the space between that part of us that is aware and that part which is going through its automatic functioning. And this dual awareness, our claim is, actually changes things. This dual awareness is part and process, part and parcel of a metabolic process that we have available in our sort of psycho-spiritual physical organisms. We have this available to us, but it's not that often activated. But when you activate it in the spirit of digestion, just like when food is digested and we produce molecules like ATP to fuel the biological system, when we activate this digestive process on our impressions, we actually produce substances of a kind that have a finer energy that provide a quality of awareness, a quality of spaciousness, and a quality of consciousness, which is at best only experienced accidentally and occasionally in our lives. But by putting attention on this digestive process and putting attention both on what's coming in and what's arising internally, we have the opportunity of actually intentionally allowing a natural inborn digestive mechanism to function fully, which will then reliably begin to create within ourselves a kind of interior spaciousness which allows us to grow spiritually.
So, if we follow out this idea that Stuart's proposing here of digestion, we can, of course, view digestion as just another form of composting, but this so we're sort of tacking back and forth.
Right. Back to composting.
Exactly.
You're the gardener.
But
I like to eat.
That's right. But there's another metaphor that we can play with here a little bit to help us understand the different kind of digestion or composting that Stuart's describing. We're all familiar with the idea that some organisms, especially ruminants like cows, have at least two separate stomachs, two separate organs for digestion. And in fact, there's something akin to composting that happens in those organs, because the substances that the cows are eating are not that highly nutritious. Something needs to happen to them to release the nutritive value of the food that's being eaten. And the process that Stuart is describing of observation, of witnessing, of substances that will become food for the organism and be digested by the organism can go in one normal direction by which these substances are digested in the ordinary way, or with the addition of this witnessing that Stuart was describing, it can go in a different direction. And the food, the impression food, can feed another part of the organism than is usually the recipient of nutrition. That second part of the organism that can receive nutrition rarely receives it after childhood. Children have the capacity to convert impression food spontaneously in a way that allows this other part of the organism to receive nutrition. But adults lose that capacity because we are trained in childhood to redirect the impression food to the part of the organism that is designed to help us follow the rules of society. And that means that all the impressions get routed to this part of the organism that Stuart described, such that we are trained and we train ourselves both unconsciously and to some extent consciously, eventually, to give our energy and the nutrition of our impressions to the part of consciousness that we've been told will make us happy. If you get married, get a job, support your family, support the community, you know, are a great lover, are this, that, and the other thing, then you'll be happy. Those are the rules and strictures and injunctions that we are given. And because we have no reason to disbelieve that that's the situation, we create the habit of directing the nutrition of the impression food that comes into us to that part of the organism that contains all those rules and injunctions and so forth. And so this other, actually senior part of the organism is starved of impression for impression food by the time we become adults. And we feel great longing. We feel something missing. We feel that things are not right, that we've been sold a bill of goods, that there is an existential zero at the heart of the world, an existential black hole that eats things. But it's not an existential black hole that's eating things. It's our habit of directing impression food to the wrong part of our organisms. I was having a phone conversation with a student who lives in Tucson last night, actually. And this woman, you know, as many of us do, has a lot of demands in her life. And sometimes those demands weigh down so much. The responsive products of digestion happening in this part of the organism that contains all the injunctions, rules, regulations, prescriptions for happiness that society tells us are true, can get clogged up, can get very heavy. And when that happens, people feel unable to do the sorts of things that in another situation they would feel perfectly light and free to do, like a kid playing with a toy. But when we are encumbered with the products of digestion, the products of composting, that do not move in the way that they're meant to be able to move, then we get stuck. And it's just, in one sense, a matter of these products of digestion, of impression food, going to the wrong place and getting clogging the arteries, as it were. And it's easy to change those things if you know the trick to do it, because you can just, thank you, you can just redirect those nutritive impressions to a different part of the organism, and suddenly life feels different.
But I want to jump in here now, because Rob makes it sound very easy. And this process is not easy, because the habit patterns of identifying ourselves with this more mechanical part of ourselves, which Rob was describing, is a very, 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 very deeply worn habit, so deeply worn that it really takes a while before any practitioner is really willing to even begin to acknowledge it might be possibly true. So just to back up a little bit in terms of putting more framework around what we've been talking about, when in our tradition we speak of humankind as having, you know, there's lots of frameworks or ways of looking at the organism. One of them that's a useful tool, and nothing should be treated as absolute, but just as a tool to use, is the notion of our division into personality and essence. And the notion of essence is that which we're born with. It's that living, spontaneous part of ourselves. It's that part as a child that feels joy without a cause and is able to be very light and free. Whereas personality is that which is acquired in us as we grow older. That which is laid down upon us, it's the rules, it's the thoughts, it's the habitual or mechanical modes of emotional reactivities to situations, which we often take because we see this in our parents or in school kids around us. And it's a kind of a functional or as if human being, and Tayu refer to it as the android because it sort of acts like a human being, that we actually require to live in this world, in this social world. The essence, on the other hand, you know, grows for a period of time when we're children, but as the android or the personality grows larger and larger and larger, it begins to eclipse or overshadow the growth of the essence. And this is not a bad thing. This is considered in this tradition a necessary thing. It's necessary to have the personality grow in order to provide the fuel or the food necessary for the essence to ultimately grow. Essence can grow to a certain point as we grow as children, but it needs something, it needs a nutrition, it needs food in order to further its growth so that it can actually allow and grow into a larger factor in our organism. Did I see a question? Yeah.
What are the attributes of essence?
So when we say that it's something that is inborn, one way of looking at it is at least the way I look at it is the quality, and I'll use the term quality, it's the quality of subjectivity, the ability to actually be the subject of experience, the ability to be aware is an essential quality. And in fact, I'll just say as a footnote that our act of observing ourselves in the way that we're starting to kind of circle around in this dual mode of attention is a act of actually stimulating and calling forth one of the few attributes of essence that's available to us to actually utilize initially. So directing attention, the ability to consciously direct attention could be seen as an attribute of essence. It's an intrinsic kind of experience it's an affirming kind of experience. I'm speaking in metaphors here because it's sort of hard to, when we're talking about something like this, it's hard to create a, let's say, a map. But I think of it as a radiative kind of place where there's a affirmative quality, whether it's joy, whether it's a sense of connectedness, whether it's simply a sense of spacious awareness. These are things that are attributes in ourselves that we sometimes touch upon. Often they come and they go very quickly. So in contrast, what does it mean when they go? What happens when a sense of spacious freedom and openness arises and then is suddenly pushed out of the way? So that helps gives us some insight into what we mean by the android or personality. So the android or personality is the part of ourselves that, or the experience of ourselves we have when we identify, that is, compulsively direct our attention on a mechanical aspect of ourselves. And I say mechanical because it's an aspect of ourselves that is called into function exclusively by exterior factors impinging on us. Do you see what I mean? In other words, the android functions by in reaction to events in the outside world.
Can it become self-aware?
The android?
Yeah.
But this framework basically says no. I mean, it is not, by its nature, it is not self-aware. Self-awareness is an attribute of essence, mm-hmm. which is often in, as I said, in eclipse, because when attention is compulsively locked onto the parts of our organism that are functioning mechanically in reaction to the outside world, and that's all that we are willing to see of ourselves, that represents mechanical consciousness, or as they say in the fourth way, waking sleep or sleepwalking. Does that answer the question?
I think so.
I'll add something else, if you will. The quality of the android that usually does what Stuart just described is stops the sense of presence, or ends that or transforms it into something else, is often associated with a particular way in which the personality or android functions, and that is through the generation or the triggering of voices in our heads. The voices in our heads that say, "What's he talking about? I don't understand this." Or mommy's voice when I go to the corner that says, "Look both ways before you cross the street." Or the voice when you pick up a particular book and you remember the teacher who read something from that book in a class. Or whatever the voice is, the internal voice that we are in the habit of thinking of as me. That's the most obvious way to see the operation of identification. The operation of identification is that voice is me. I am that voice. That is my thought. And I am that thought. So when a thought arises and we identify with it, which is accept that that is me and I am that thought, then that is the classic example of the operation of the personality or android. And when we direct our consciousness such that there is no such thought, there is no voice, or at least if a voice arises, we do not identify it as me, then there's room for the impression food to go to this other being aspect of the organism.
It seems that it changes the control from the android controlling to the essence beginning to use the android in its own service.
Yes. So
that's the ideal.
Yeah.
That's the ideal. That's you're sort of describing the beginning point and the end point in one sense of at least a stage of this process. That the this is kind of a classic fourth way idea that personality is sort of the active element. It is in control. The essence is the passive part of ourself that's along for the ride.
Right.
And think about that for a moment. That's not just a metaphor. That's a very precise description of our interior experience. Think about the experiences we have of sort of knowing our lives could be different, but feeling ourselves sort of inexorably controlled by this persona that is dragging us along, where we feel frustrated, we find, you know, things aren't happening the way we expect, or we make an intention to do something, and the next moment we do something differently.
Would you call it passive, though? Passively along for the ride?
Yeah, passively along.
Passive.
Passive in the sense that it's...
letting inertia carry.
Yeah.
The inertia of the operation of the personality carries things along.
Right. So you have this personality factor that's controlling the action or the activity of the organism.
At the outset, before...
Yeah.
Okay.
So to your point, ultimately, the idea of the process is that there's something else that can happen, and that's that ultimately the essential part of ourselves can become stabilized and grow and become the center of gravity of our existence, such that the essence becomes the active element and the personality becomes passive to the essence, and that we can use our wonderful attributes of personality and our quirks, our warts, our talents, you know, all of the things that we have, we can use it, but we use it in service of something else. And the interesting part of this analogy, in the fourth way, everything happens with three forces. There's active, passive, and there's reconciling. And in the beginning stage, you know, the thing that sort of keeps the personality and the essence in this locked sort of role where the personality is dominating and essence is passive is the force of life. The force of our lives constantly reifies and continues to keep us kind of in this place where we're constantly reacting mechanically to these outside forces that are coming in. So we have to find something internal, something inner, to become that that reconciling role. And that's part of what shifts us. And that inner thing is our practice, is our work on self. It's turning towards something higher or more within, if you will, that becomes more of a factor in the source of impressions that have gravity with us. We tune into something deeper in ourselves. We tune into something, if you will, higher in the universe or more absolute in the universe. And that allows life to be, as Walter was saying, a dream. It becomes less of a reality, and it becomes more of a dream. And what becomes real is something deep within.
So, the problem, as Stuart pointed out earlier, is that it's easy to explain why or what's happening and what should be happening in place of what is actually happening for the most part in most of our lives most of the time. But actually changing that is the tricky part. Why is that? Well, you know, we've just talked about a situation where these voices in our heads are problems in the sense that we identify with them, and when we identify with them, then they become the master, and they're the tail that wags the dog, essentially. So that is a problem, but what most people do with that situation when it's described to them is that they'll decide that, oh, this thought, that's a problem. And maybe that thought, that's a problem. But the trick is to recognize that any and every identification is a problem. It's the habit of identification itself that's the problem, not this particular identification. That particular identification. There are dozens, probably hundreds of psychological techniques to rearrange the deck chairs in the ocean liner of our minds to something that we think will be more pleasant to hang out in. But as long as we're engaging in the habit of identification itself, we're just going to, that habit of identification is just going to glom onto some other deck chair, even if we decide to release this particular one. And that's the tricky part.
Yeah, I'd actually we got into sort of details here. I started my last riff with the comment that this is very difficult. And I want to reiterate that, because one of the hardest things I certainly have found, and I continue to struggle with this, and that's after, you know, decades of practice, recognizing when I'm identified.
Would you define identification? Yeah. I realize that identification is the cause of all suffering.
So there's a
what is?
Okay, so I can tell you when you think that there's a feeling that you associate with I. You know, there's a sense you have with me. Like, for instance, my hand. You have a sense that there's no separation, that this is your hand, or your hand, not my hand. Arlie, you probably think this is your hand too, but he's my mom. Yeah. But there's a very deep energetic sense of continuity. This is your hand. So imagine now applying that same sense of familiarity, and just, you know, you wouldn't think of cutting your hand off. You know, it's a part of you. So imagine that same sense of connection and familiarity with an emotional state that arises. They say someone upsets you. Someone does something that kind of makes your vanity, you know, you feel like you were offended or something like that, to use a negative emotional example. That when that happens, when we're identified with the feeling that arises, we see that as absolutely valid. This is who we are. We couldn't possibly not be right or wrong in that moment. There isn't like perspective or anything like that. There is simply this complete sense of I-ness with that manifestation. Now take that same model, not just with an emotion, but with a complex of thoughts and an energetic state of tension in the body, and you have a sort of an android three-centered manifestation that feels absolutely familiar to us. You know, a good example for me the other day, I can't remember where I was, but I saw this in a way that I hadn't seen it before. I was feeling, I was at a music workshop. You know, it was kind of an all-day, like, five-hour shakuhachi workshop where I was working with my teacher with a group of people. And toward the end of it, I was just noticing that I was starting to watch the clock. You know, it's like, when is this going to be done? You know, because it was real work, because we were having to put, like, active conscious attention on our bodies and on our plane. I noticed something I hadn't really seen clearly before, was that the complex of thoughts that were sort of arising about, oh, it's time to go, I really, you know, I'm starting to fantasize about being in my car driving home and stuff like that, was in reaction to an energetic state in my body. And the energetic state in my body was a certain kind of tiredness, because I'd been on my feet for hours, but I was identified with it. I didn't see any difference between it. As soon as I caught that, I could simply attend to changing that energy and shift my attention, and then it was as easy as Rob says, I can just redirect my attention. The problem here, and the reason I say this is hard, is that I had to see, and this is after 25 years of practice, I had to see that I was identified in that moment. And my challenge to all of you who approach these ideas, even if you have some, even years of spiritual practice under your belt, is it's very difficult to actually recognize the stark reality of the identified state of our ordinary consciousness. It's very difficult, where we're so used to, oh, if I feel this particular way, then I'm going to do this. I feel hungry, I'm going to go eat. I feel tired, I'm going to go sleep, or all of these things. But all of this is us being identified with body-mind states that are functioning in this organism, and those states are being triggered by things outside of ourselves. That is not essence functioning. That is the machine being the active force in our lives. That is not essence functioning. Yeah.
I don't understand how hunger and fatigue can be coming from outside of us. And that seems that anything is coming from within, certainly within our bodies. So I don't understand that. I don't understand what you're identifying with. I mean, you're saying, oh, I'm a tired person. I don't want to be a tired person anymore.
My point, I'm not saying that the body shouldn't sleep when it needs to sleep, right, and you shouldn't eat when you need to eat. On the other hand, for instance, much dysfunction around eating has to do with, you know, people who have a physiological reaction of hunger and then mechanically eat to make that feeling go away. So, yes, there
or,
is...
Or when hunger arises, there is a habit that hunger is filtered through an emotional complex which stimulates, say, overeating or undereating, denial or excessive eating. There's lots of ways that our psychological makeup creates cascading sets of habits that produce effects which become inscribed in the organism, you know, and it's as predictable as the sun rising in the morning, practically.
You're talking about something like Pavlovian conditioning?
Sure. Well, I mean,
it is like Pavlovian conditioning, but it gets complicated because there
are very sophisticated bells that ring in our world. But we still bark and we still drool.
We still bark and drool, but it's usually a set of things that are not even aware of at the surface level of consciousness. We're not seeing most of the levers that are, you know, it's like a Rube Goldberg kind of thing. You know, there's, you know, something pushes that lever and a ball drops and then water falls and makes this go up, and we don't see any of that. We just see this impulse over here and then this response way over here. And what we're suggesting is that this set of effects that are in a sense the process of unconscious internal composting, or, you know, what happens when you're not looking at this process, can be changed, but only when you see, as Stuart's pointing out, you see all the levers, you see all the actual effects, such that sometimes, and not infrequently, and we're used to this, you know, right now, I've had a lot of tea. Should I just, you know, relieve myself on the floor here? I don't think so.
Because you're the right one who would have to clean it up.
Exactly. Damn right. So the same thing happens with hunger. Sometimes it's appropriate to eat, and sometimes it's not appropriate to eat, even when you feel hunger.
But let me just, before we go to your question, let me just take hunger as an example. There's being hungry and eating when it's appropriate, which is a body, and that can be a very natural process. But most of us, like when we're hungry, we get cranky, and that's where we start. That's where that hunger becomes yet another trigger for an identified state, and that's when the sensation, the body sensation, is simply a trigger or a reactive trigger.
Yeah. Hunger is a very simple manifestation, and it does not have to have all the consequences. It might not be cranky. It might be anxious. Some people get anxious when they get hungry.
Well, there's lots of. We have a question over there.
Yeah.
How do you respond to the Zen koan, when hungry, when tired, sleep?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's. I think we're sort of responding to that in a roundabout way, which is that that's not, what, if you're hungry and you eat, and if you're tired and you sleep, and that's all there is to it, that is a very natural relationship to your organism. But if you're hungry and someone's standing in the way of you getting food, and you start sitting there sort of tapping your foot in the ground and sort of starting to think dark thoughts about this person who's standing in line in front of you, because, and they're taking a long time at the cash register, and you can't get your Starbucks muffin or something, then something else is going on, because we're identified with that state.
But then it's not in the hungry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's how we respond. What we're talking about is not some sort of artificial denial of the natural process of the organism. We're talking about, this whole segue is about trying to shed light on this notion of identification. And
sure.
Identification means when you take the body state that you're in as the sole totality of your experience and lose yourself in a reactive flow of associations triggered from that state, then you've lost the naturalness that Zen koan speaks of.
Right. The reactive flow of thoughts and emotions is just what that is being pointed to in that statement. That instead of, oh, I'm hungry, so I'll go pick an apple from the tree and eat it. Instead, oh, you know, I had a big breakfast this morning, so I should have something light for lunch, maybe low fat. And
dish is too salty.
Yeah,
take it back.
All these things, all these thoughts, all these emotional reactions. That's what that's about. That's what it's pointing to.
But aren't there emotional states that lead to, like, anxiety, mm-hmm. depression, that lead to compulsive eating?
Sure.
So it isn't hunger, it isn't a physical hunger in a way.
Right.
It might not be
yeah.
often, but then those are always, you can see those when you get when you develop the habit of practice, the habit of witnessing. Then you can start to see the operation of those parts of the personality that are producing these bizarre products of compost, of a composting process that we're suggesting is not natural, as compared with the process which small children experience. So, for example, in a number of cases, we can observe a small child that is denied something that she or he wants, and they cry. And then 5 minutes later, it's over. It's done. It's on. And it's forgotten. Literally, just gone. If for a very young child.
Try the same thing with an adult.
Yeah.
And you get war.
Really? You get mobilization of forces. That's right. You get the political process. You get all kinds of stuff.
In the fourth way, the term that's used in the classic fourth way is keeping accounts. So if you look within yourself at factors in your psychological mechanism that keep accounts, remember people who have wronged you, remember grudges, hold on to that stuff, that's keeping accounts. And keeping accounts is one of the functions of the android, or the personality.
Right. The essence does not do that.
Right. The essence is like the little kid. You know, it's like
right.
There's an immediate affirmative response to the reality of life, and then there's life changes, and there's a new response to life.
Now, it's also true that this property of, or the properties of essence, are not necessarily devoid of the ability to create negative karma. So even after we achieve the relative clarity of no longer compulsively having to identify with the operation of the personality or android. Even after that is more or less stabilized in our presence, still, the essence may need to learn stuff too. But the essence learns in a way different than is commonly understood in our general understanding of education. It is not a process of putting more and more words, stuffing our organism with more and more words. Essence learns by demonstration. In other words, it learns by impression, food, through the imbibing or digestion of impression food.
So you mean practice?
I mean practice, but I also mean being open to experience without buffers, without defenses. That's one of the things that these aspects of the personality provide. It's the reason, it's one of the main reasons that we go along with the inertia of creating a personality as small children, precisely because we understand it instinctively to offer a kind of defense against impressions that we are afraid of or don't want to admit into ourselves. The classic example I use is you talk to a 5-year-old girl about something that she doesn't want to hear. She will not look you in the eye, generally speaking. And when she's not looking you in the eye, when her attention is directed away from you in this very clear way, she's not really hearing you. What she's doing is taking your words into her ear and inscribing them as part of her now developing android or personality. Those then become part of the substance of that part of her consciousness. Whereas, if instead she were able to be absolutely present, to hear what you had to say without prejudging what you had to say, then that impression food would go to this other essential part of consciousness and be able to feed that part of the organism, if you will. So actually the ways to distinguish these things are fairly simple and straightforward. If it's speaking to me in my head, then it's part of the personality. And it's part of a complex which is essentially defensive in nature, whose goal is to defend me from impression food, defend the essence from impression food that it thinks it's supposed to defend the essence from. But what it ends up doing is creating a great sack of manure that we carry around with us, which is composed of all those words, all those messages from the universe that we were refusing to hear at the moment they were enunciated to us. And so another part of the process of reversing the inertia of the android or personality is to go back and witness all those messages, to be present to allow the essence to be present to all those messages that have accumulated, and that is a process that takes time, but it can discernibly lighten the load that we carry over time as that process proceeds.
You don't have to work miracles overnight, in the sense of you don't have to suddenly become a saint in the next moment. It doesn't work that way. is actually a like composting. It is a long process of metabolism, and the process begins by becoming aware within when we are identified, and beginning to push against that identification. So self-observation as a practice begins to allow us to, as we said much earlier, see the triggers coming in, see the reactions arising, but recognize that is not me. Simply watch the functioning of the organism. You don't have to do anything initially. You don't have to change the functioning of the organism. Actually, by breaking the identification with the organism, even though that particular automatic manifestation may have a lot of momentum, and so, you know, it would be take a lot of energy to change it, but if we simply recognize that's not me, that in itself, that simple momentary act begins to shift the polarization that we talked about earlier. It begins to cause the grip of that android to loosen. And over time, when this is repeated more and more, a inversion can take place where that which is innate, that which is observing, that which is our being, that which is our essence, is able to ultimately have the center of gravity such that the mechanical response actually has very little energy in comparison to the depth of presence that the essence has. Which is why long-term spiritual practitioners tend to have a kind of a presence, a kind of a heft about them, a spaciousness and a inner quiet, because there is something substantial that is there that has a greater center of gravity than the functioning of the personality or the essence.
Yeah. And a very rudimentary approach to this might be to try and break your mechanical responses, the way you do things mechanically, like changing a certain habit, brushing your teeth with another hand, opening a door with another hand, putting thought on these things as you do them.
Yeah, I would say that those are all very good practices of stirring things up.
Yeah, just breaking your mechanical.
Any one of those things works for a while and then becomes mechanical in its own right. That's just the way it works. You know, it's just like if you put a sign on your refrigerator saying "Wake up," the first three times you'll wake up, and the fourth, fifth, sixth time you will sort of be dully stirred, and then you ignore it. I mean, that's just the nature of the organism. So part of the...
And then you know it's time to do something else.
Well, yeah, part of skillful...
get your attention.
Right. Part of skillful means is constantly changing the pattern. And if you remember, some of you have probably read Frank Herbert's Dune and seen the movies and things like that. If you remember, the way you avoid the sandworms is by walking randomly on the sand. And in a way, that's a wonderful metaphor.
So as not to produce a regularity,
right,
that the monster will hear and be attracted,
right,
to.
But those are basic. You know, those are sorts of things that kind of
just little beginnings.
Yeah, they kind of wake us up. They're not necessarily, they're good things to do. They're my experience is the, like, disidentifying with emotional states is probably the hardest here. Disidentifying with thoughts, a little bit easier, still kind of challenging. Disidentifying with body states is pretty hard, unless you're an athlete, and athletes tend to push themselves against, body arisings. But, yeah, all of those things.
But the trick is and here's why, in one sense, the metaphor of composting is so appropriate here. The most effective, the quickest form of composting is a very precise admixture of ingredients to the compost, such that and size of compost, such that you actually get an internal living response, which raises the temperature spontaneously.
What was our last talk called? spontaneous ignition and conscious suffering.
And
there you
conscious
go.
Suffering. That's right. So compost, when it's a compost pile, when it's assembled with the proper constituent elements in the proper way, in the proper size, will actually spontaneously heat up, and that process of composting will happen far quicker than happens naturally. I mean, the duff on a forest floor is essentially very slowly composted material that's fallen out of the trees, fallen onto the ground, and been very slowly digested by, you know, at random by various organisms in the forest floor. That's a process that takes a long time. What we're suggesting is possible with spiritual practice is something that can resemble the operation of a compost pile produced by a knowledgeable gardener who understands how to create this kind of manifestation deliberately in order to speed up, to vastly speed up the process that would happen without that intentionality at a much slower rate. Much slower rate. Okay? And that distinction of knowing how to create those conditions appropriate such that the compost actually heats up spontaneously is essentially what spiritual practice is a good metaphor for spiritual practice. The use of a variety of techniques, and every tradition has these, and they're different, of course, for each tradition. But it's bringing them together in a skillful way to create this effect.
So you have a set of practices that lead into this. Mm-hmm. But I want to know, do you have to tailor the practices to each individual? I mean, is it an across-the-board kind of thing you do, or do you have to work with each individual according to...
That's always the most effective way. So... you know, when organizations get really big, then most people, the vast majority of people associated with a teaching or tradition, will end up employing the scattershot techniques that are most widely applicable to everyone. And there's nothing wrong with those, but for the person who wants to learn how to create this skillful means compost pile, this spontaneous ignition compost pile, that person will almost always need a considerable amount of personal attention from someone who knows how to do this. Because it's not enough just to have a formula of what to put in the compost pile. Because the condition and situation of all the constituent elements, you know, the freshness of the leaf or the age of this or that, that will affect whether this reaction gets started and you actually get some heat going. And a skillful spiritual friend or teacher will have an intuitive, as it were, but actually essence or being-based understanding of what will be helpful for a given individual. Because all of us, whether we want to or not, are wearing our internal lives on the outside. We like to think that we're cleverly not displaying our internal life, but every time you have a thought and identify with it, there is a residue of that is displayed in your body for other people to see. and a skillful practitioner can see that, can see those those residues, those effects. And so it's helpful to have someone who can do that to help you choose particular practices at particular times, apply them in a particular way for a given time, and then discard them temporarily or permanently as is appropriate, given what it is you have to do. Maybe you have, you know, when you're constructing a compost pile, sometimes you have to haul stuff from a long way away and sometimes from a very short distance. Sometimes you want to add something that you have very little of, so you need to go find it or get it. And that metaphor is appropriate for this internal process as well. Well, any last questions?
You were mentioning impression food. Mm-hmm. And by impressions, do you mean like... What's your definition of impressions? Like, is that like my first impression of a particular person is that he strikes me as this type of person, or is that an impression? Like, what do you mean by impressions?
That's a good question. I mean, that would certainly be an impression. Mm-hmm. In other words, in fact, that's how I have. In my personal life, I have returned to that quality of childishness, if you will, or childlikeness, if you will, I know instantly whether I like someone the first time I see them, just like that, as a kid does. A kid knows instantly whether they like someone or don't like someone.
But I would say that they...
But that's one just one form of impression. So more generally, right now, your body, your organism, is receiving a multitude of impressions, physical impressions about this space, about the humidity of the air, the warmth of the air, the way your body is touching the floor, the chair, the way your clothing is touching your body, and you know, all that stuff, plus the psychic impressions of the people in this room, of the mass of people in this town, of all kinds of other stuff as well. I was going to say, yeah, the almost full moon. Some people would argue that that provides impression food as well. Certainly the light at night provided by it is an impression. Everything you're aware of...
And not aware of.
And many things you're not consciously aware of are impressing themselves upon your organism. You are tremendously more sensitive to a vaster array of data about the universe internally and externally than you are likely to be aware of most of the time. And so one of the attractive things for people about drugs, for example, is that some drugs will allow you to become aware of some of these forms of data that your habit is to suppress, and that can be very interesting. It's not a good idea, in my opinion, to make use of that avenue, you know, as a habit, because then you get the unfortunate effect of associating being aware of things that we are all capable of being aware of only with the ingestion of certain substances to assist that process. And that kind of hobbles one psychically and otherwise.
Not to mention there's all sorts of bad, some some horrible things that can happen with the use of this.
Not to mention, indeed. Got it. So indeed. But that's one of the reasons that people that people are can be attracted to that.
But let me just add a context in terms of just tying that definition of impressions back to what we were saying earlier about how we block integrating or digesting these impressions. When all this data is coming in constantly, our aspects of our minds are constructing this universe, and there's only certain things that we'll pay attention to, and we'll respond to certain things in certain habitual ways. And part of the process of breaking identification is challenging those constructs and actually trying to make ourselves fresh to these impressions once again, like we were when we were little kids.
I want to ask something about you're in a state now where when you meet someone, you know instantly if you like them.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when you meet someone and you instantly dislike them? Are you looking then for a trigger that is causing that feeling in you? Do you try to examine why it is that you have an instant dislike for somebody?
I'm always
off from that, you know, and think, well.
I don't second judge the impressions. I just note them as data. It's not. See, if just because I like someone doesn't mean I have to act in a certain way around them, or not act in a certain way.
Someone.
Well, that's my point. Just because I have this instant
or
dislike
around towards someone,
right? Or dislike usually arises because something like I don't trust that guy. I don't trust that guy, or something like that, or something like that. It's usually on that level, it doesn't have to govern how I interact with that person, and I certainly don't second guess it. But my practice for for over 3 decades now has been to always be witnessing and interrogating my experience, always. So that's nothing special that I have to add. You know, I suppose wonder why that strong impression came up for that person. But I don't have to know these things. That's one of the things that that people get in the habit of, because this is another one of those things. You know, from there was a gentleman asking about a Zen koan earlier in the Zen tradition. There's this clear articulation of dispensing with the judgment of things as good or bad. The good or bad comes out of the android personality aspect of judgment. Just because I don't like something doesn't mean they're good or bad. Doesn't mean they're bad. And just because I like someone doesn't mean they're good. It's this simplistic. All it is it's a single snapshot at this moment. This impression arose in my consciousness. Oh, that's interesting. It does not have to govern a single thing, because I am striving always through witnessing these things neutrally and interrogating anything that seems to stick around for a while, as to, oh, what the heck's going on with this? What's arising in me? Why is it arising? Who am I? What am I doing? And why am I doing it? That's the formulation that Robert Ennis had.
As a footnote to that, I time-honored fourth way technique for dealing with an impression that arises like that is to move closer to the person that's causing that trigger.
Exactly.
That's
see what it's all about.
Well, that's one form of what's called conscious suffering, which is the willingness to move against the inertia or the gradient
or
that
the imagined threat.
Right. And to then do that with a kind of presence where you're seeing what's being called up so you can scrutinize that more clearly. That's a more advanced kind of practice that one becomes engaged in after one has more of a foundation of just being able to establish internal presence or internal observation. But that's a way that you can do what Rob was describing, to explore when we discover the triggers in our lives, when we discover the things that cause this stuff to arise in us, then we can start to actively go towards it. And that's part of how you accelerate the composting process.
Did you want to add one?
Yeah, what do you mean by interrogating your experience? Is that some kind of analysis?
No. I just mean asking those questions, what am I, who am I, what am I doing, and why am I doing it? And not necessarily using a voice in my head, but having this sense of wishing to ask who and what I am.
Being open to seeing.
Being open to seeing stuff. That's exactly right. So I want to conclude, if that's acceptable to you, with an observation about Walter, since he is subject to, or the person we're dedicating this talk to. It was my good fortune to get to see him in many contexts, but I mentioned at the Sutra Salon earlier. And in the Sutra Salon, we read a variety of different Buddhist texts. And some of them were wonderfully inspirational, beautiful, and a pleasure to read. Others of them would involve what for many of us would be incredible mental drudgery in exposing oneself to lists of, there's a particular set of texts called the Vinaya, for example, which is the rules that Buddhist monks are supposed to follow and how they were codified and how the Buddha proclaimed them and so forth. And most people, a lot of people just stopped reading them and then came back after the Vinaya was done, or would be constantly at every meeting sort of complaining, oh, here is this stupid rule, and blah, blah, blah. And Walter, at his 87 or 88 years, or whatever it was at the time, explained with his incredible vivacity and capacity for enjoying life, how he loved reading the Vinaya. It brought him closer to the Buddha, because it's all stories about people misbehaving, monks misbehaving, and the Buddha telling them how they screwed up and why. And now there's a rule for dealing with the situation, and here's what the rule is. And he thought it was just wonderful. It was this source of inspiration for him. And I mentioned this because I want to underscore the point that I made earlier about the student in Tucson that I mentioned. What I was attempting to point out to her is that these reactive responses to life are only compulsory and compulsive when we surrender our responsibility to them. And when we do, life becomes heavy and hard to bear. But when we learn the trick, as Walter did, of letting go of that habit of identification, then life can be this series of wonderful adventures and investigations and disclosures, exciting, no matter how old or young you are. I think that's a good place to end unless you have a final comment.
Just we should speak to any gardening classes that we offer.
Right. Okay. Yes, we have right there over on the window there. There's something you can see called Refuge of Presence Practice Group, and that's a group that we have here every Tuesday except the fourth Tuesdays of the month. That's when the Sutra Salon meets in this space. We also have some monthly co-meditation workshops. The next one will be on Saturday, February 13th. That's at Taiyu House, about 3 miles from here. And there's various other activities from time to time. And if you want to be apprised of those, you can ask Ambo or Daniel here to write your name, your email down, and we'll add you to our email list. Let you know about those. Well, if you're not on the store, that's a separate one from the store email list. If you want to be on the store email list, to be apprised of things happening in the store, that's another one. But we also have a separate Taiyu email list as well.
And last but not least, we operate these talks on the basis of Dana. So
which is donation.
Donation. There's a donation bowl, so if you can find it to give a donation, we would appreciate it. Tonight's donation goes 100% to the store.
Yay!
Not to the speakers.
Thank you so much for coming.
Good job.